welcome to the Old Time Radio Hour. I'm your host, Justine Ward. This week we have the second half of a charming and informative documentary about the great comedy show Vic and Sade. It aired for many years throughout the 1930s and 40s in a quarter-hour format during the daytime, when most of the shows were soap operas. Creator and writer Paul Reimer brought a whole town to life with the conversation of a family in the living room. Some of Reimer's own relatives were surprised to find themselves quoted in the off-the-wall humor of this brilliant show. The documentary was made over many years with loving care by longtime radio professional Jack Foster. He offered this two-hour documentary free to any station that wanted to broadcast it. It was broadcast around the Los Angeles area in the 1970s and early 80s, sometimes with the addition of an interview with Jack Foster. Enjoy part two of this 1972 documentary tribute to Vic and Sade, created by Jack Foster, with voiceover by Gary Owens, broadcast over KCSN Public Radio.
Well, sir, you remember last time we talked with Bernadine Flynn, who played Sade, with Bill Idelson, who played Rush, with Clarence Hartzell, who played Uncle Fletcher, with Bob Brown, who did the announcing, with Johnny Coons, who played Smelly Clark, among others, and with Franklin McMahon, who, like you and me, loved to listen to Vic and Sade. Now we're going to continue our conversational tour of Paul Reimer's truly unique expression of the everyday humor of middle American life.
Well, sir, the evening meal has been over only a little while as our scene opens now. And here in the living room of the small house halfway up in the next block, we find Mr. and Mrs. Victor Gook. Vic lounges in his easy chair with a newspaper, while Sade, occupying a corner of the Davenport, darns gentleman's socks. Sade is speaking at the moment, and rather sharply, too. Listen.
You don't need to titter and get that funny, surprised expression on your face every time I mention going to Carberry next Saturday. We're going to Carberry, and that's all there is about it.
Why, how determined you sound.
Sure, I sound determined.
It's not like you to be so high-handed.
No, there's no reason on earth why we shouldn't go to Carberry either. You've got nothing else planned for on Saturday. You're free as a horse. Well, Vic Gook, you haven't been to Carberry in ages.
You have, though.
Well, of course I have. A dozen times, and Rush, too. But you haven't.
Your sister?
What?
Bess is your sister.
Now, that's a fine, beautiful excuse, that is.
Well, it isn't, is it?
Bess and Walter are your sister-in-law and brother-in-law. And they live right here in Illinois. Not even a whole day's ride on the train. And you let year after year go past without visiting them. Why, it's shameful.
I don't notice them coming to visit us.
Well, you appreciate Walter's tied down with the barber shop and all. He can't get loose. But you're as free as the breeze. 100 million times I've itched to try to talk you into running up to Carberry, but always knew you'd kick and bellyache and raise objections. Now an occasion has come along. Something special's on the fire. You can't duck and sneak off and hide your head under your wing.
What's the occasion?
You don't know what the occasion is.
Sunday, just because young Yuntsey's gonna slam off a tune on the half-wit piano is hardly sufficient.
Yes, young Yuntsey's gonna slam off a tune on the half-wit piano. For months and months, she's worked and practiced and worked
somebody
and
in the
practiced.
Kitchen. Somebody in the kitchen.
Robbers, maybe. You, Willie?
Yeah.
We'll start laying our plans now, this very minute. I'll write Bess a little note, and Rush can mail it tonight so she'll get it tomorrow sometime. I'll tell her to expect the three of us on the IC train that gets in Carbon.
I got
a
picture with me.
Evening, Sadie.
Well, we got company.
Hello there.
Hello, Bess.
Come in, Uncle Fletcher. I'm not going to be sidetracked on this now. We're going to Carberry, and that's all there is about it. You can wipe that foolish, perplexed look off your face, too.
Bumped into Uncle Fletcher Society up at the corner of Kelsey Street just now.
How are you, Uncle Fletcher?
Yes. Coming along Kelsey Street there, minding my own business, and ran right into this scallywag rush. If I'd done right, I'd have called a policeman and had you thrown in prison.
Yeah.
He's a good boy.
Hey, Uncle Fletcher's going to Carberry with us.
Oh?
Aunt Bess invited him to come to Yuntsey's piano recital, too.
Receive a letter from Bessie, did you, Uncle Fletcher?
No.
Well, sure you did. You were just telling me about it.
Uh-huh. Sadie, remember Tracy Flanker's there in Belvedere?
No, I don't believe I do. Are you going to Carberry with us on Saturday?
Tracy Flanker's had a secret hiding place for his money a thief wouldn't discover in 30 years. It was up against the roof of his mouth. He had a little leather strap back there somewhere close to his tonsils, with wires that hooked on his wisdom teeth. Baffle any burglar in the country.
Say, that's an interesting thing.
Yes, Tracy Fletcher.
Uncle Fletcher, Rush tells me you heard from Bessie today.
I did. Mailman left a letter over at the house sometime during the afternoon. I wasn't there at the time. I was over at Miller's gasoline station. Fella pulled in with Missouri license plates. Elderly fella. I went in to chat
with
him.
Well, did Bessie invite you to come to Carberry on Saturday?
No.
Well, you said she did, Uncle Fletcher.
Please let me do the talking for about 5 seconds.
Well, if he's going to go, I won't have to go, will I? Make too many for Bess to find beds for if the whole gang of us traced up there.
Please. Uncle Fletcher, there's something I have to get straightened out. Are you going to Carberry on Saturday?
Yes, I thought I would. Yuncey's going to play on the piano.
Yes. Well, do you plan on...
Yuncey Vick performs a selection where she stomps on the white keys with both feet.
Is that a fact?
Yes.
I think you got that a little bit twisted. It isn't the white key she stomps on with both feet. It's the loud pedal.
Let's say enclosed a printed program in the envelope. Good many of the different ones is going to play. Yuncey's best, though, I guess. I'd like to see her come stomping down on the white keys with both feet.
Well, are you going?
No.
Well, a minute ago, you said you were.
I forget the name of the piece Yuncey's going to perform.
I remember it. The Aurora Borealis Elegy in Gallop.
That's right.
Composer's name is San Francisco.
Yes. No fella move there. H.D. Glatch. Remember H.D. Glatch, Sadie? Belvedere fella?
No.
H.D. Glatch moved to San Francisco to spite his father-in-law. Who'd he marry, Sadie?
I don't know.
It was either Ivy Stover or Opal Sponk. H.D. Glatch married one of them, and Crawley Sopman married the other. They don't cut any ice either way, though. Case of 601, half a dozen of the other. If H.D. Glatch didn't marry Ivy Stover, he must have married Opal Spunk. Well, whoever he married, he moved to San Francisco to spite his father-in-law. That's about all I remember about H.D. Glatch, and all I want to remember. I never liked H.D. Glatch. Never liked Ivy Stover or Opal Spunk either. A whole outfit of them can live in San Francisco, and I won't lose any sleep.
Uncle Fletcher, will you answer me one question?
Yes.
Are you going to Carberry on Saturday, or aren't you?
Certainly enjoy watching Yuncey stomp down on the white keys with both feet.
It's a loud pedal she stomps down on with both feet, Uncle
will
Fletcher.
Will you keep out of this, please? You are going to Carberry, then?
In the printed program, it tells about a fella and his grandpa going to play the piano together. I wonder if the fellow's going to sit in his grandpa's lap.
I have to find out whether he's going or not. It'll make a difference in our plans.
Well, I won't have to go if he goes, huh?
Of course you'll have to go.
Why?
Well, just because you will.
With thunder, Bess and Walter haven't got accommodations.
Bessie suggests I pack a lunch to eat on the train, Sadie.
Oh, does she? Well, then you are going.
Train stops 15 minutes in Mendota if you want to get something in the depot lunchroom. But like Bessie says, it's pleasant to have your own shoebox with oranges and bananas and a few sandwiches. I always like to give the conductor a sandwich. If I give the conductor a sandwich or a cookie or some little dainty, and he don't get cross and impatient when you ask him if the train's on time. That's the main enjoyment I get on the train. I like to haul my watch out of my pocket and say, "Are we on time, conductor?"
Then you are going.
Puts the conductor in a good humor if he's munching on a piece of bread and meat. You say, "Are we on time, conductor?" And he'll sit on the arm of your chair and talk along free and easy as a horse. "No, we're 2 minutes late," he'll explain. "But we hope to make it up before we get to Freeport."
Then you are going.
No, I always slip the conductor a little something to nibble on. Remember Arch Van Geekrock there in Belvedere?
No.
Arch Van Geekrock traveled from Yellow Jump, North Dakota, to Dismal Seepage, Ohio. Good long journey. He wanted to get on the good side of the conductor, so he gave him a sterling silver watch, a derby hat, $2 in cash, and introduced him to his niece that was just 22 years old and pretty as a picture. The conductor put the watch in his pocket, slammed the derby hat on his head, bought cigars and candy with the $2, and married the niece. Arch Van Geekrock tells it to this day it was the pleasantest trip he ever took in his life. This goes to show you how smart it is to shine up to the conductor.
Uncle Fletcher, are you going to Carberry Saturday or not?
No.
You're not?
I did have it in mind to help Cully Sanderson out at Miller's gasoline station Saturday afternoon.
Well, have you still got it in mind?
Cully Sanderson don't actually need me. Business is pretty slack.
Doorbell's ringing.
Go see.
Most likely Bluetooth Johnson.
Fred and Ruthie, maybe.
Oh, they wouldn't come without telephoning first.
Oh.
Why are you looking at me, Sadie?
Oh, I was wondering if I ought to ask you whether you're going to Carberry next Saturday again or not.
You suppose Yuntsy takes off her shoes and stockings before she stomps on the white keys with both feet?
It's the loud pedal she stomps on with both feet.
Otto Hiefler there in Sycamore used to be pretty good on the piano. He had a piano he made himself out of corn cobs, baling wire, and horsehair.
Telegram.
Never looked like a piano, and never sounded like a piano.
Telegram?
But Otto Hiefler...
Yes, George...
Telegram?
Yeah, for you.
Where from?
Oh, no. Can't tell.
Well, give it here.
Probably you recollect Otto Hiefler, Vic. Married a woman 36 years old?
No.
He married a woman 36 years old without saying aye, yes, or no to anybody. I'll marry this woman 36 years old, he said to whoever'd listen. And he up and did it.
How old was he?
Otto Hiefler is 40.
Oh.
Here's the telegram.
Who is it from?
Bess.
Oh?
Yuntsy sprained her wrist, practicing, scraping her fingernail down along the white keys of the piano. Will not be in recital.
Why, say, that's too bad.
Yeah. What's all this?
Little Yuntsy hurt herself on her piano.
Broke a toe, maybe.
Oh.
Broke a toe stomping on them white keys.
Mm.
Well, that's that, I guess.
How you mean?
Well, we won't be going to Carberry.
Oh, yes, we will.
But say to that poor little
child... We're going to Carberry on Saturday. All of us.
Those who remember Vic and Say delight in recalling the incredibly outlandish circumstances that were the mainstay of Reimer's humor.
I think it was the kitchenware dealers. We're going to have a convention, say, 10 years ahead, or more than 10 years ahead. In 1955, they're going to have a convention in Hawaii. And now, a convention 10 years ahead, and to Sadie, whose horizons were so small, And I think she'd be afraid of opening up anything extending too far away from home, you know. So he was all enthused in what they could do in Hawaii, and he talked about it quite a bit. He'd bring it up every now and again. You'd just wait till he'd sail off to Hawaii. And she'd say 1955. Well, you know, it sounded like 2075, something like that. Anyway, she'd heard enough. And at one point, she said, oh, that Hawaii, I wish it was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And she dismissed that. She just didn't want to hear any more about it. It was too far in the future. It was too far away from home. It had everything wrong with it.
B.B. Pantley discovered the second flavor in peanuts. And when Rush kind of scoffed at this, Vic says, well, he says, you know, you've had this experience. You've started a bag of peanuts, and the peanuts had one flavor, right? And when you're down the end of that bag, the peanuts have a different flavor, right? And Rush says, well, that's not it. He says, that's copyrighted in Washington, D.C. It took B.B. Pantley to discover that. That's the kind of discoveries that make people, you know.
Fletcher is complaining to say that his landlady, Ms. Keller, is going away on a vacation, going to be gone a week or two, and she has... is going to put all of his meals for all the days out. Breakfast Monday morning is going to be on top of the piano. Lunch is going to be on top of the bureau in the bedroom, and so on and so forth. Where all these... He's quite put out about it.
And, of course, Uncle Fletcher, Clarence Hartzell, he's a 24-carat nut, and he was wonderful. I remember he told Rush one day that he was going to give him a piano for his birthday, but by parts. And he said, this birthday, Rush, I'm going to give you one key. And before the episode was over, Rush figured that it would take him 88 years just to get the keyboard, and the rest of the piano would, he'd have to live to be 150 if he got the strings. But Clarence, again, had his own bucolic type of humor that fitted in beautifully, this thing.
Oh, I love the ones where Fletch would be reminiscing, bring over a cigar box full of mementos or a photograph album showing the pictures of some of his old cronies and friends and what had happened to them. And this one is now in his Missouri State Home for the Tall. And this one ran for mayor and got beat. And he ran for governor and got beat. And he ran for Congress and got beat. Had one lifelong ambition to run for president and get beat. Something like that.
It was George McPulper also that had the exciting political life.
Who is it?
George McPulper run for coroner and got beat. He run for street commissioner and got beat. He run for sheriff and got beat, and he run for superintendent of schools and got beat.
Huh.
You know what his big ambition was, Vic?
No.
To run for mayor and get beat.
Oh, very funny.
You know, Vic, I never thought of that as being funny before.
Did you?
No.
Mr. Gumpox, the garbage man, drove a horse-drawn garbage wagon. Even Mr. Gumpox's horse figured in the doings up and down Virginia Avenue. The horse's name was Howard.
Mr. Gumpox had two suits. One was for Sunday and one was for every day. Would come a time when the old working suit was no longer good enough to wear any place. So then he would put the Sunday suit on and buy a new one for Sunday. And the former Sunday suit would be the work clothes. So he showed up the stall to get Howard on Monday morning, and Howard saw the Sunday suit and wouldn't get up. He thought it was Sunday and he wouldn't go to work.
Howard had a sister who pulled a garbage wagon in another part of town. Years later, someone remembered.
Bill Cullen had a show out of New York some years ago. He played recordings of Vic and Sade, and probably maybe from the station where he was working. I had put a few aside. And he ran them. And then he had a contest. I think, the contest was who could name Mr. Gumpox's horse Howard's sister. The sister horse, Howard's sister, would sometimes take over for Howard, or I think worked for another garbage.
That wasn't Bernice, was it?
That was Bernice. And so Bill Cullen was offering a prize to anyone who could come up with the name of Gumpox's horse Howard's sister. And the prize was free parking space, I think in Dismal Seepage, Ohio, or someplace like that. Yeah.
Sometimes the comedy spilled over into real life.
Oh, yes. I remember one time the script was to revolve around Sadie getting a new garbage box. And when Rush and Vic came home, she hauled him out to the alley to see this. She'd been so long in getting it. Her other was decrepit, and she finally had this spanking new beautiful garbage box, and she was so happy with it and so proud. She dragged them out to see it. She got out there, and, well, the coincidence lay in the fact that my husband, being a doctor and a busy man, was a very infrequent visitor at the studio. We had our separate careers, and neither one interfered with the other. And he loved my work, but my husband came down to pick me up, and I looked up, and there he was in the control room, and I was at the microphone, because reading the script, there I was out showing Rush and Vic my new garbage box, And I said, oh, no, they couldn't look what they've done. All marked up. And Vic said, oh, it isn't all marked up. There's kids will do that. There isn't much. Look at that. It's just been ruined my beautiful garbage box. And what it said on it, she said, Bernadine loves Chester. And Paul couldn't have known that my Chester was coming to pick me up that night, because I didn't know it myself. And if any two words for the names of a man and a woman could be funnier than Bernadine and Chester, you've tried to find them. So that's what Paul had written on the garbage box, and there was my husband. So I had seen him, so I read it just like that, just with all the disdain and disgust in the world that Sadie was feeling.
at the beginning, at the very start, when Vic and Sade started, we broadcast in Studio B, which was a big barn-like studio that was used for musical shows. And way over in the corner, they had one of these tents erected. It was a three-sided thing with sort of a heavy burlap. It wasn't really burlap, but it was a heavy sound-absorbing material. In the middle of that was this box microphone. It was a show where we were supposed to run and go into the cellar where we were supposed to eat strawberries. And we rigged it up so there was a microphone in the tent, and there was a microphone in the anteroom, which was, you know, like 50 feet away. And on the top of that mic, there was a box of strawberries for us. So we were going to run from this one microphone. We ran into the anteroom and started eating strawberries. And it was like being in a dark cellar. And we just did it because it seemed like more like acting, you know, and more theatrical. And I remember I kind of started to choke on the strawberries. They got caught in my throat. But there were a lot of things that happened like that in these early days. And we were convinced that nobody was listening anyway. So why worry about it? There were a couple of times where we got our pages mixed up. And we'd hand each other scripts. There was not much pressure because we felt at 8:15 in the morning there maybe were four or five people out there listening. And the pressure only built up later when the show became top rated and we were on for Procter & Gamble and so forth. But those early days were really funny and fun.
I'm not going to tell too many stories about Paul, but he always, I think, had a feeling that he had to outdo people or kick them off balance. For example, he went into a store on North Clark Street in Chicago that was going out of business and had been a photographer's shop. And he bought up these great big mammoth picture postcards, and you'd be enjoying a life of tranquility at NBC, and suddenly the mailman would come in, Paul Reimer would be on vacation, and the mailman would hand you a postcard. And on back of this postcard would be your name and address, NBC, and then over here a message to you. Dear Robert, if you don't stop looking in my window while I am undressing, I am going to tell my father, signed Mabel. Well, of course, this had been read by every person in the mailroom, and everybody down the line that had a crack at it knew that Bob Brown at NBC was being assailed by some young lady for being a peeping Tom. And this was Paul Reimer's idea of fun.
I remember a director on the coast I had worked with in Chicago, and I was doing a show, I don't remember what it was, and he'd open the mic and say, Clarence, honey, would you go back to page so-and-so and take out the sentences of that top speech, and okay, Clarence, honey. Then he realized what he was doing, so he had to explain to the cast, he said, I'm using an old Vic and Sade gag when I do that.
There's a story about Reimer's mother, which is a true story, by the way, is she brought her sister in to Chicago, and Paul had set it up so they could go into the control room and see the show. And Paul's mother was just a very plain kind of housewife who really didn't understand radio at all. I mean, the whole thing was a mystery to her. Well, there were pickups from New York. There was an announcer in New York who did the commercials. And they cut from Chicago to New York to get the New York announcer doing the commercials. And she had been told that at one time or another and didn't really know clearly why that was. But in bringing her sister on, she assumed a very authoritative air and a very professional air about this whole thing. And she was pointing out the various things in the control room, and that's what the man twists, and that's a microphone, and so forth. And then she saw the announcer out there, and she pointed to him, and she said, and you see that man? He's in New York.
But earlier than that, she came to Chicago one time fairly early in the show's history, and she took me aside and she said, is Paul doing all right? I said, oh, Mrs. Reimer, he is considered one of the finest writers of comedy in the country. Well, she said, you know, I just kind of worry about him. And I said, well, of course you do. But, oh, he's respected everybody here and in New York and all over. His writing has been accepted as very fine. But once we were invited to Bloomington, and I think that showed Mrs. Reimer, and I'm so happy because she had every right to know that. They were honoring Paul. We were met at the station by the high school band, and we rode down the main street in an open car, standing and waving, you know, and Paul muttering what he would mutter under his breath. And we went to perhaps, I don't remember, it could have been a high school gym or a Masonic lodge room or something for a fine dinner. And there was Mrs. Reimer up at the speaker's table, and they were saying these lovely things about her son, and I think it finally really got across that he was doing all right in Chicago. And then I remember one time Paul told us that Sister Bess lived in Carlisle, Illinois. We had another name for the town, but Bess was the one who'd write all those fine letters saying, dear sister and all, Walter's kneecap is let a fine. It was years before we knew there really was a Walter and Bess, you know. Anyhow, she went to Carlisle one time to visit them. And when she got back and Paul asked his mother, he said, well, how do they like the show in Carlisle? And she said, oh, you know those people. They wear those flat shoes. They don't listen. She was the non sequitur lady of all time.
And when we went on the air, it was quite a serious thing. We did it. Everybody, it was a serious thing. We were not doing a funny show. We were doing a serious show. And as a result, it sounded real. But going home after the show, I'd think back on some of the lines. I'd sit on the L train, I'd bust out laughing, and I'd get so embarrassed because I'd see people looking at, what the heck is he laughing at?
I remember some funny muffs. You know, when one of the funniest, Vic was supposed to come in and say, butterscotch pie. And on the air he came and said, scutterbotch pie, which made us all laugh so hard. And there were a number of things that happened like that where we would really break up. And it was almost impossible to continue. And especially when I was in adolescence, in the giggly stage, you know, I would break up and I just couldn't continue. I'd go over in the corner and Van and Byrne would ad-lib until I could kind of get myself together. And we were not helped at all by Paul Reimer, who would sit in the control room and laugh like a fool. I mean, the tears would stream down his cheeks. Because he would tell us that he had completely forgotten the script by the time it was on the air, which was maybe a week or two after he'd written it. And he said it was like absolutely fresh material that he'd never heard before. And when he heard it, he thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard in the world. And he would fall off his chair in there, you know. And I remember one show was, I would do anything to get a recording of this thing, was just Vic and I, and Vic was breaking in a pipe for his boss, Mr. Rubish. Well, he starts out very big explaining about pipe smoking, and he's such an authority, and how you tamp down the tobacco and everything. And then as he smokes the pipe, he gets a little sicker all the time as he goes. And he finally, he just belches, you know, and Rush says to him, gee, Gov, you look so strange. What's the matter, you know? And he can hardly speak. But Van and I used to break up at the end of this, so we couldn't really do it. And there was another one we did also where we were supposed to sing at a father and son's banquet, and we try to sing together, and we can't get it right. Well, we repeated this several times, and Van and I never got through this script. We never got through it, even though everybody in the control room got down behind the counter. They all got down behind the counter so we couldn't see their faces. And we just looked in the control room, and there was just nobody to be seen. They were all down under the counter. And Van and I looked at each other and just blew up. I would give anything to have tapes of those two shows. They were just unbelievable.
Before going on, let's take a moment out for station identification. We'll be back in just 5 seconds with a tribute to Vic and Sade.
You're tuned to Radio in the American Tradition, 88.5 FM, WAMU, Washington.
Now, let's go back to January 4th, 1943.
Well, sir, it's early evening as we enter the small house halfway up in the next block now, and here in the living room we find Mr. and Mrs. Victor Gook. Vic is seated in his easy chair reading some sort of brochure, while Sade, on the davenport, languidly scans the newspaper. And at length...
Is that another large catalog?
It's the thing that come in the yellow envelope the mailman left this afternoon.
Is it another large catalog?
Yes, after a manner of speaking.
Trying to sell you more junk, are they?
You speak with unwonted harshness, Dr. Speech.
Well, by golly, they'll gobble up a person's last nickel if you give them half a chance.
We still got a couple of nickels in reserve.
What they got for sale this trip?
A sort of intangible commodity. Lodge headquarters, through some source or another, have acquired the rights to it.
Oh, that's Ruthie, calling about 500.
Thought you girls had a definite date.
No, we left it up in the air. She had to wait and see how Fred felt this evening. Been kind of halfway off his feed.
Oh.
Hello? Yes, lady? Oh, finished supper half an hour ago. Got my dishes done besides. Uh-huh. Why, I bet we'd love to. No, I don't even have to ask the big muckety-muck. You scalawags, come right on ahead. Oh, now listen. No, but he's forever doing that. Well, if he insists on being stubborn. All right. That crazy Fred says he's going to bring over ice cream or know the reason why.
Crazy's right.
What flavor you want?
Caramel.
Chocolate?
Caramel.
Vic is running around the room on 1 foot screaming and yelling for chocolate, Ruthie. Yes. Well, fine. Chocolate, then, if chocolate's agreeable with Fred. Yes, I guess I remember Fred's fond of chocolate flavor. All righty, Ruthie. You betty, lady. Goodbye.
Caramel.
Put your shoes on.
They're under my chair here. I'll grab them when sweet old lovable Fred arrives.
Now, don't you be short and sarcastic with Fred tonight. He's not quite up to snuff these last couple days. Ruthie said he sneezed 3 or 4 times in succession at the dinner table this noon.
How horrible.
Well, you just remember to be pleasant.
I will hold Fred to my breast and protect him from every wind that blows.
Not a single darn thing in the newspaper. Except for the little daily love story. It's just so much piffle.
Did you read the front page?
Nah.
There are 1 or 2 items of interest to be found there.
What's the lodge trying to sell you this trip?
Honorary titles.
Oh?
Headquarters has somehow acquired possession of quite a list of them. And they're cheap. I may invest in a few.
What kind of titles?
Well, here we have... Member of the Board of Directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad.
I don't understand.
Well, it's simple enough.
You'd be that?
For a fee, sure. Let's see, what is the fee? 35 cents.
You pay 35 cents?
Uh-huh.
And what do you get for it?
The privilege of calling myself by this title.
Well, why would you want to do that?
Oh, it'd be nice to adorn my business cards. Could be an asset in many ways. Suppose I wanted to impress somebody. I could tell them that, aside from being the head of the bookkeeping department at Plant 14 of the Consolidated Kitchenware Company, I also had the honor of being a member of the Board of Directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad.
Is there such a railroad?
Sure.
And for 35 cents paid into the lodge, you'd actually be on the Board of Directors?
Well, in a purely nominal way. I wouldn't, of course, go and attempt to establish myself as an executive. My power in the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad would be definitely limited.
Would you have any power at all?
Well, no.
Well, what a dandy red-hot way to spend 35 cents.
It's the impressiveness of it, Sadie. The glamour, if you will. You know what pride you take in being president of the Thimble Club.
But I am president of the Thimble Club.
So am I, a member of the Board of Directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad. If I pay my 35 cents.
Oh, ish.
I know it sounds a little fakey and feeble on the face of it, but in modern business and progressive civilization, there are wheels within wheels.
I'll say.
Well, I can see how my having a little like a title like that might rebound to your gratification.
Uh-huh.
Suppose you ladies are at somebody's house having a bang-up thimble club meeting, and Ma Epperot gets to bragging about her uncle or her nephew or somebody. As slick as grease and as poisonous as an adder, you can softly say, "How nice for him. Did I ever tell you Mr. Gook is a member of the board of directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad?"
I can see myself.
It's just possible. It's just possible. Here's a son of a gun of a title.
Mm-hmm.
Ex-monarch of Prashunya and Baskadrill, Hulliver Island Group, Caribbean Sea.
King of something?
Ex-king of something.
Oh, now that's the limit.
It is a trifle extreme, yeah. If you had that on your calling card and got to showing it to people, there might be doubts and skepticism.
Yes.
Here's one of the more reason to it. Lifetime honorary president of the Tom Bashaw Fine Arts College for Young Women, Dismal Seepage, Ohio.
Uh-huh. College president. It'd look nice on your calling card.
$1.20.
Oh, worth every penny.
Here's a long baby. Member of the High Board of Executive Regents Inactive Pro Tempore. Two crosses, a plume, and a garter without portfolio for collisionary interstate trusteeships between Maine and Nebraska, Kentucky and Minnesota, Indiana and Texas, without recourse to recall and unconditionally vetoed notwithstanding.
That's all one title?
Uh-huh.
How much? $900?
10 cents.
My stars.
It's too wordy.
Yeah.
And for 6 bits, you can call yourself captain and manager of the Sick Valley Hotshot Girls Softball Team, all-time free-throw champions of the Slag Mountain League, Lower Swilly, Tennessee.
Oh.
And for $1.15...
Who can that be now?
Bluetooth Johnson.
Bluetooth is with Rush down at the YMCA.
Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan.
Yeah, I suppose. Hello? Oh, yes, lady. Oh, got slowed up, huh? Well, goodness, we're not impatient. Take your time. No, just sitting here talking. You're just this minute leaving the house? Well, dandy, but don't hurry yourself and get all out of breath. Just take your time. Sure. What? All right. Fred hollering again.
Carmel.
You run childishness into the ground.
I'm always a poor half of the...
Oh? Why, we decided on chocolate flavor, didn't we? I'm pretty sure we decided on chocolate flavor. Just a second. That absent-minded scalawag of a Fred went to work and forgot what flavor ice cream we decided on.
Caramel.
Chocolate, wasn't it?
Caramel.
Yes, chocolate, Ruthie. You bet. Well, we'll be here, so don't feel you have to run or anything. All righty, Ruthie. Goodbye. Caramel.
Hey, there's a chap in Yellow Jump, North Dakota, that bought himself a dozen titles. Set him back 50 smacks. Listen to all the stuff he's got on his calling card. Edward King, 712 West Wood Street, Grape Hunch, Alabama. And here are the titles. Keeper, controller, warden, and manager of the Ohio State Home for Bald-Headed People.
Good.
Oh, that's only one. Supreme vested authority of the Drowsier, Minnesota Coal, Coke, and Lumber Company. Co-captain, left tackle, coach, and chief rubber of the Lame Apollo football team, Shine, Kansas. Member of the board of directors of the West Virginia, Charleston, and Rapid Shuttle System. Member of the board of directors of the Overhead Cantilever Bridge, Bass, and Bluen Building. Surgeon-in-chief of the Slusher Junction, Arkansas Bicycle Works. Indefatigable prime potentate...
That's all on one calling card.
Huh?
All that mess is on one little calling card?
Sure, and there's a half dozen more titles I haven't read.
What's the fella do?
How you mean?
What's the fella actually do in real life?
Oh, let's see. He tells her someplace.
Huh?
Oh, here we are. Edward King, holder of this impressive list of titles, carries a newspaper route as his regular business.
Oh, my.
He, of course, has gone a little too far with his titles. They won't wash. They're not plausible.
No, they're not.
Some of them are kind of appealing. I wouldn't mind having that railroad one, for instance. Victor R. Gook, member of the board of directors of the Salt Lake City, Southwestern Montana, and Pacific Deadline Railroad. Only cost 35 cents. And I rather fancy this one here about...
Dolphin's ringing.
Most likely Smelly Clark.
Uh-huh.
No, but about these titles. For a dollar or so, a
fellow
could...
Well, maybe. What a hunter. Oh, you're at the drugstore. Well, I wondered. Oh? Oh, uh-huh. I see. Well, just a second. The drugstore's all out of chocolate-flavored ice cream.
Caramel.
Strawberry?
Caramel.
I think Fred likes strawberry better than caramel.
Caramel?
He likes Tutti Frutti better than caramel, too. Shall I tell him to get Tutti Frutti?
Caramel.
Caramel, I guess, lady. Yes, caramel.
Despite the sometimes outrageous things they did, the characters on Vic and Sade seemed so real that we might wonder whether the actors themselves became the characters they played, at least to some extent.
Not that I know. It's possible, but I usually know when I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. But I don't just absentmindedly do it. No, I don't think I do. Do I, Bill? I don't remember ever doing that. But if I know I'm talking to a fan of Vic and Sade, then I may.
I'll say yes and no. Yes, in this way that it the association with Paul and his writings changed my conversation. I found I was a little more flip in those days and facetious and was constantly using some of the little sayings from the show, like fine, or he's a good boy, or you'll enjoy that. It came out in conversation more than anything. It took a while for it to go away. Because people today wouldn't understand that.
Well, I think toward the end, after they had gotten so deeply into the characters and had become so at home with each other and had become so capable of interpreting what Reimer wanted to have them interpret, I think they had a devil of a time getting back into their own personalities, because I know Byrne, who had been a very chic, sleek, coiffed, the latest couture, suddenly became a nice, matronly sort of a person. She married in the meanwhile, but she suddenly became a Sade. And Vic became even more waspish as the time went on. And Rush became even more, in a sense, challenging to Vic, to make Vic, because Rush loved to provoke Vic in the scripts. He would say things and Vic would blow up, you know. And the same thing with Uncle Fletcher, that Rush and Uncle Fletcher understood each other and the two of them would needle Vic. And they grew to the point where I think they were living these lives. And I think it was wonderful, because so few shows offer any inducement to become a part of them. Everybody was heart deep, knee deep, hip deep, emotion deep in that show. And Paul did nothing to foster this. It's what Paul wrote that fostered this.
But he had such a sense of rhythm. Everything went in threes, which makes a rhythm, of course. When you read the scripts, and if you look for that, you'll see it. It's kind of like music. Banal as the words may be, ordinary as the conversation may be, it's woven beautifully into a tapestry of rhythm, and you can't break it. But we didn't start out that way. He used our idiosyncrasies to build on, and we recognize ourselves sometimes and laugh. I came down one day wearing a pair of glasses, and I was at great pains to tell him it wasn't my eyes. It was these headaches I had, and the doctor thought that if I wore glasses, I wouldn't have these headaches. But my eyes, I can see anything. I can read anything. I don't need them to see with. Well, Paul Reimer wrote a script about Sadie and the glasses, and I felt like a fool because here, which I was, here was Sadie obstinately proclaiming that the doctor ordered glasses for her, but she didn't need them to see with.
But the whole family enhanced what Paul wrote, and Paul could write for the family. He had this wonderful feeling for people in his writing, and certainly for the people that read his lines. Because we would break up in the studio. I there's many a time when the curtain went down and the last line had been read, such as these episodes when Vic got into his lodge clothing and he trips over a sword and he falls into a washpan full of clothes that Byrne had put on the kitchen table, and everything is crashing around, and it was a sound effects man delight. We'd break up in the control room at the point that when I had to come up and read the closing Crisco commercial, it was all I could do to keep a straight face, and some of the times I just broke up in the middle of the commercial. Of course, Bill Ramsey loved this. He didn't mind this at all. It was great. Thankfully, we had a client that didn't. But it was a show where there was a wonderful, close-knit quality between Paul and Byrne and Vic and Billy. And if I may say so, Clint Stanley, who was the producer and of whom Paul always wrote in the show about Third Lieutenant Stanley up the Amazon, and myself. And one of the reasons I think that Vic and Sade was great was certainly Paul, certainly the cast, certainly the what little production that had to go into it, because the cast intuitively knew how to read Paul's lines. But I think it was the fact that in the midst of a welter of tears that began like at 9 o'clock in the morning with John's other wife and ended at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with some other bathos type of thing that went on the air in those days, Vic and Sade, with its little warm daily vignettes with no cliffhanger to worry about for the next day, each episode stopped right in the middle. Vic and Sade was a sort of an island of sheer delight in a sea of tears. And I think that's another reason it was a great success.
But, see, Paul, it was in his writing. He even underlined words. And occasionally we would get a green director, some new man, and they thought some of the NBC executives had the mistaken notion that the play would run itself, the series. Like some directors feel that a play, once it's established in New York, can be sent on the road and it'll just go on and on. They fall apart. A director has to be there, and a director has to know his show. Well, sometimes we were handed over to a new director. No fault of that man. It wasn't a lack of ability, but in this particular field, he was unaccustomed to it. And I remember one we had. And it had to do with lines like this, that Paul would underline certain words. For instance, Sade and Vic, maybe Rush, would be sitting on the front porch. And they lacked anything momentous to tell each other. That happens to all of us. So they'd say, "Oh, there goes old Mr. Johnson. He's got his little hamburger." Or, "There goes old Mrs. Fuddlefingers. And she's got her little bag."
Well, I guess I have to admit I belong to a pretty red-blooded, active set of fellas. My arteries pump away with
there
energy.
There's Mr. Kreider.
Uh-huh.
Got his little quarter's worth of steak from Croucher's Meat Market.
How do you know?
He gets a little quarter's worth of steak every evening. Cooks it himself and eats it himself.
Aim to buy it in the bulk. The other day I saw Eugene in Tapman's vacant lot.
That was Mr. Clark.
Uh-huh.
Got his little umbrella up.
Wonder why. The rain stopped.
Well, he carries it to keep off the sun. He had sunstroke one time and's been scared of it ever since.
Yeah?
Well, he always wears tennis shoes on account of that, too.
Because he got sunstroke?
Mm-hmm. When he was a young man working on a farm, he keeled over from the heat. Affected his ankle some way. Had to wear tennis shoes ever since to be comfortable.
Funny place to get sunstroke, an ankle.
Yeah, but that's the way it is.
Pretty nice sitting here in the porch swing, huh?
Lovely day, all right.
Ain't you glad I called you out?
Miss Simmons turning off on Kelsey.
Uh-huh.
She's got her little girl.
And so the director said, "This Mr. Johnson has his little package of hamburger. Mr. Johnson doesn't have his little package of hamburger." He said, "This is the way the author underlined it, and there's a reason for that. It has to do with rhythm, with what touches off a spark in people, makes them respond to it. That's the humor. That's why Mr. Thurber said it's beautiful to one line that somebody else couldn't understand." And so we honored his underscorings. And we also honored, he did a thing that is rather rare, interrupted conversation. It rarely did anybody finish a sentence any more than they do in a family sitting around talking. But you had to interrupt where Paul Reimer indicated, or you broke the rhythm.
Michigan Fishigan from Sishigan, Michigan, finally married Jane Bain from Payne, Maine. Later died.
Two names that don't appear, at least I haven't heard them in discussions of Ickenshade, were Mr. Kidney Saddle and Mr. Chestbutter. I can't remember what Chestbutter and Kidney Saddle did, but I think this has almost the quality of Dickens. They're wonderful names. You can Chestbutter, Kidney Saddle, Beef Punkles. Paul had a way with words. The words were ridiculous, but they had a sonority. They had a beautiful rolling quality.
Yeah, and Paul, with his great perception and his great genius, you know, he made those characters, that made us, a combination of the characters from his own childhood, his own father and mother and himself, and he combined that with what we were as people. Somehow he amalgamated those two things so that those characters became very organic for the three of us. He knew our own feelings about things and our own personality so well. He wrote for us, and yet he was writing about his own life. And it's funny, it's my feeling that he was Rush half the time, and he was Vic the other half the time, because he had his own son. And when Vic spoke, sometimes it was Paul talking to his kid, and sometimes he was Rush talking back to his old man and to his mother. So it was really strange, the things that happened, the wheels within wheels, as Paul used to say.
And never has a group of performers displayed so much sincere respect for one another.
We all did have tremendous respect for one another, and we all thought the other actors on the show were the funniest, most wonderful people we knew.
They were perfect. They grew with the show, and Paul wrote for each one.
This is not to say that there were not momentary conflicts and little bits of temperament and pique, and we would get sore, but down deep, you know, we all loved each other very much. And in order to work well together for 12 years, there had to be that feeling, you know. We were a real family.
And Paul Reimer was our best audience, by the way. And instead of saying, look, I want it this way, look, he said over and over again, I thought this script was a bunch of nothing till I heard you people do it. He gave us full credit when we really didn't deserve it.
We had fun in radio in those days, though. I just wonder if they have as much fun in television today.
Mary Fran told me one time that she had to be someplace, and Paul did his writing at home. So in a period of walking around and thinking about things, he strolled out to the kitchen, and Mary Fran had a maid helper, come in about once a week and clean things up, for whom she would leave notes telling her what to do, what she wanted, whether to wash windows in the living room and vacuum the dining room or whatever. And Paul went out in the kitchen, and he wrote these notes. Then he took off for the afternoon, because he didn't want to be around when there was cleaning noise going on. And out he went. Mary Fran came in first, and she saw these notes. And they were something like this. Gloria, Mrs. Reimer wants you to move the kitchen stove over to the west wall this afternoon, and she would prefer to have the kitchen sink over near the refrigerator. And there's plenty, we've measured, and there's plenty of room for it. And he had this poor little maid, her job that afternoon was moving all the heavy kitchen equipment all over the place. And that's the kind of thing. He lived it. He was always a joy and a delight to be with.
Vic and Sade was unique in another way. The people that Jack Foster interviewed, professionals with many other important shows to their credit, felt without exception that being a part of Vic and Sade was the most important thing of their careers.
Oh, we enjoyed doing that. It was no work. That wasn't work. That was pleasure.
I don't know any program that I ever walked in the studio to announce and look forward to like I did Vic and Sade.
I don't think there'll be anything that I can do to top what I did on Vic and Sade.
Oh, unquestionably. I think that was the... I know that that was the thing that brought me the most satisfaction. I think that the part of Uncle Fletcher was the best thing I ever did and the most enjoyable thing and the most rewarding thing that I have ever done, spiritually particularly.
Yes, it was the most important thing I did in my career as an actress. I felt and feel that it was very important. The work you're doing generates a feeling of perpetuity. It really does. Beside that it can reach so many people, so many surprisingly different people. It is a very worthwhile thing.
Oh, I don't think there's anything that can come close to it. I've always enjoyed everything I've done, mostly, but this was an outstanding thing. I felt very honored that I got a chance to work in it, because it is a classic. It'll always remain a classic. Clarence Hartzell, of course, came in to Vic and Sade later, in the late 30s, I believe. He was fantastic playing Uncle Fletcher, and he was a funny man, and just great. Billy Idelson's a very fine actor, and also a very fine writer, as you well know, and doing very well in California at the present time. There was not any funnier man than Ard Van Harvey. His timing was so perfect. He was a great dialectician, which not very many people knew, and he did funny stories. And Bernadine, who's a beautiful woman, and still a beautiful woman, and a fine actress, just great. But and Paul Reimer, he used to just die laughing. He wrote the thing, and he would get it going. He'd come in the control room, and we'd be on the air, and he's falling off his chair laughing at the stuff that we're reading that he wrote. You know, just fall on the floor.
Such an artist. He got the very most out of every syllable, every word.
Well, Paul was something else. Paul was a man that I idolized. He's been my idol in life. In two ways, as a person and as a professional, as a writer, I learned a great deal from him. I think everything I know about comedy writing comes from Paul, and I also admired him tremendously as a man. I thought he was really one of the distinctive characters that I ever ran into in my whole life. And I, as a matter of fact, I named my first son Paul, after Paul Reimer.
But I see it as great writing, ranking among the writings of all American humorists, the best, living and dead.
And even while it was on, you know, everybody had a different viewpoint of the show. There were people that just saw it as a kind of a cute slice of life, you know, and that the people were kind of like the people that they knew, maybe a little dumber. And there were relatively few people that saw a commentary on a portion of American life and saw it as a really brilliant satire, which it was.
Paul was a craftsman. He led you so nicely. He never left anything hanging. His words were, as I say, there were none wasted, and everyone painted a picture that was fantastic. If ever an epitaph is written on my gravestone when I pass on to the great radio station in the sky, I can think of nothing nicer on my gravestone than he used to be the announcer for Vic and Sade.
Which concludes another brief visit at the small town halfway up in the next state. Let's hope we can get together again sometime. Our thanks to Daryl McAllister of NBC AFCO Broadcasting Corporation, and Miami University at Oxford, Ohio, for their contributions of special material, and to the State Historical Society of Wisconsin for the use of their archives. This tribute to Vic and Sade was produced by Jack Foster for distribution without charge to radio stations everywhere. This is Bob Arbogast speaking.
Arbogast? Wasn't Arbogast from out of St. Louis?
No, Uncle Fletcher. It was Dismal Seepage, Ohio.
Went into the powdered rabbit business, married a woman 27 years old, and later died.
Of Vic and Sade.
You are listening to the Old Time Radio Hour, broadcast each week throughout the World Wide Web. Subscription is free on iTunes, Podbean, or RSS. We are so happy to have you join us this week, and we look forward to sharing another hour of Old Time Radio with you next week, if you have time to tune in. Until then, this is your host, Justine Ward, saying, so long for now.